Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Oh, church, when did we lose our way?
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back with part two of my interview with Dr. Thomas Kazin. Thomas is a professor and chair of biblical studies at Stockholm School of Theology, University College Stockholm. He has authored numerous books and articles in English and Swedish, including Moral Infringement and Repair in Antiquity and Impurity and Purification in Early Judaism and the Jesus Tradition. Today, we bring him back for part two of our talk on his new book, Dirt, Shame, Status, Perspectives on Same-Sex Sexuality in the Bible and the Ancient World. And again, we go deep into the handful of references in the Bible to try to understand what it would have meant to the people who would have heard it in ancient times. And again, just a warning, we definitely cover some topics and some references to what would be absolutely considered sexual assault in modern day times. And there is some language that may be offensive to some, but again, very important topic to cover. And hopefully this is beneficial to those of you listening. So without further ado, here's part two with Thomas freaking Kazin.
No church.
Yeah, that brings to mind the ancient practice also of, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast before, invading armies, you know, the victorious army using sex as almost weaponized against the defeated army and quite frankly, you know, rape, you know, they would rape their, yeah. Talk about that a little bit.
That to degrade someone, to shame someone by penetrating them, whether a male or a female has been something that human beings have engaged in for thousands of years, I think. And it all builds on this hierarchical understanding. For example, you have a Greek vase painting where Greece is symbolized by one male with an irrigated penis, and Persia, which was conquered at that occasion, is symbolized by another male who is bending over with his ass protruding, and on the other side of the vase. The Greek man is just about to rape the Persian. And the text says, I'm Evromedon, I bend over. So that's kind of commemoration of the battle at Evromedon where the Greeks won.
Yeah, it's not something that I think a lot of people are aware of, historically speaking, mm-hmm. and certainly very graphic. But again, I think it's important to understand that some of these ancient references in text are it's not always so clear cut in terms of I think that's clearly not a representation of a consensual same sex relationship. Obviously that is an act of violence against another person. Within a society that has a very clear, hierarchical structure in place and clear definitions in terms of, honor and things like that. And that's one of the things I wanted you to talk about as well. Cause I think you point out in the book also that even between, honor and shame, honor was something that was more distinct to the male gender versus shame that was more distinct within the female gender.
Yeah. Females were supposed to be deferent, to show deference and to have a low profile in the public sphere. Before we enter this, can I just add another text on the previous topic? Because we've got this interesting text from the Middle Assyrian laws from the 11th century BCE. Now they are old, right? And they say that if a man spreads secret rumors about his neighbor and says that everyone fucks him, that is, everyone penetrates him, he will be very, very severely punished with lashes and a heavy fine. But if a man actually fucks his neighbor, if he penetrates his neighbor, and they prove it and find him guilty, what happens then? Then the other male shall penetrate him, shall rape him. That's a punishment, and castrate him in addition. So there you've got, it's not the sexual act between two males that is considered the problem here. But it is the fact that you have got a male who's penetrating another male, a companion, is the meaning of the Akkadian word. It's another male at the same level, and that is the problem. And the appropriate punishment then is supposed to be to submit him to the same treatment by the collective, because he is. Because he has shamed this person, right? Now, of course, if it's a matter of a woman, she can also be shamed, of course, but not in the same way. And shame is a tricky issue, because on the one hand, for a male to be shamed is a catastrophe. For a woman to display shame is an honor. Shamelessness is one thing. That's bad. But to have the proper type of shame, the proper amount of shame, that is, in a sense, honorable. So a woman's honor is her shame. And then we realize that shame has a broad shade of meanings, because it always has to do with your place in your proper place in the hierarchical order. And of course, in ancient culture, there are movements back and forth how much freedom women have. There are periods in which women gain, you know, more independence and more freedom, and there are periods when there are backlashes. And very sadly, when the Christian religion becomes established, we find many examples of repression, further repression of women's space and agency. In many ways, I mean, we've got these post-Pauline or pseudo-Pauline texts which tell women that they are not allowed to teach, and they should just keep quiet and be subordinate to their husbands. And when we get further into Christian history, it doesn't get better at all. And of course, there are other examples in ancient history. And the most interesting thing, I think, is Sappho and the group around Sappho at Lesbos. And I mean, we're back around 600 BC. It's even before the Israelite exile in Babylon. it's early, right? And the poetry that has been found in fragments and partly reconstructed by Sappho is remarkable because of the lack of hierarchical structure. It's of a completely different character compared with male poetry of the same of similar kind. When Sappho describes love between women, there's a mutuality in this, and a feeling of love in this, which is very absent from corresponding male poetry. Males who wrote poetry, well, they wrote pederastic poetry. They wrote about boys whom they adored, and they warned about them getting too old and hairy. The poetry is very coarse. And it's very misogynistic. They think that it's better to love teenage boys than women because women have no brains. Well, it's a noose. The understanding the sense that. Women particularly have less of or lack. Pederastic poetry is kind of built upon a very low view of women all the time. Those who penetrate women, they are just like animals. One of these poets says Straton of Sardis, but we have an advantage because we have invented anal sex. So. But those who have sex with women are just like animals. Some of those texts are not very nice to read, and I must admit that when I've been working on this for some time, I was quite fed up with some of these expressions because they were so disrespectful. And it's still. I mean, it still surprises me how big the difference is between the poetry of Sappho and the pederastic poets, which you find through several centuries.
Yeah, it's remarkable what we can learn from, you know, some of the societies that existed along the same time period in which a lot of these religious texts were written. And one of the things you point out at the end of the book as well that I think is really interesting and important to kind of discuss, because I think it helps us understand how we should treat these texts, is that the ways in which we kind of view and the modern lens through which we view religious texts versus secular texts is completely different now versus back then, and you kind of talk about that a little bit. So explain what you meant or what you say in the book about that.
I'm afraid you have to clarify the question because I didn't quite
Yeah, so you talked about in the book about how we view religious texts today, as being sort of a higher level, versus secular texts. Versus, back in ancient days, religious texts were sort of, religion in general is sort of baked into the fabric of society. There was no real distinction between the two, but yet today, we would read something in Paul, but not necessarily read other contemporary manuscripts alongside it because we.
I get it. Yes. I mean, religion is a function of society, it's a function of culture. We would often want to think of religion as something special, something timeless that kind of floats unchanged through times and cultures, through the centuries, through the millennia. But that's not how religion works. Religion is constantly changing, evolving, if we go back in time, religion was based on the same level of understanding, of knowledge, of science, etc., as culture at large. So it's only really in modern times that religion has come kind of backwater, area of reactionary and conservative ideas that do not keep up with science and with the general level of knowledge in society. I think our world would look quite different if religion had kept pace with the rest of development in society. And many people think that religion is supposed to be some kind of safe guarding old traditions in a very conservative way and is kind of bulwark against new developments so you've got this weird situation where many religious people don't believe in scientific findings and don't believe in evolution. They don't believe in vaccines. They don't believe in whatever. That's not the place of religion in history. That's just a fraction of history, the last few hundred years, this thing has happened. And when it comes to texts, the idea of religious texts being absolutely normative, in a sense, is also a very weird idea. Because if we look at the history of holy texts, they have been changed and rewritten and complemented and interpreted through centuries and millennia. And that is completely necessary in order for human beings to be able to use ancient texts with some kind of relevancy. And I usually say that religious texts cannot be normative. They are formative. They can be formative. And with formative, I mean that they shape and they influence human cultures and human thinking. But we constantly negotiate with them. We discuss with them. We interpret them. We discard some of them and we keep some of them. some of these texts become irrelevant to us because we know more things and other things. We do not, you know, we cannot entertain the idea that in these ancient texts, every single truth about human life and human society and the human world, every physical law, whatever, was revealed in some mysterious way. They are all dependent on their context, on their culture, because that's why they were relevant back then. And they cannot be relevant, these texts cannot be relevant to us in the same way as they were relevant to some people back then, because they reflect a different world. But maybe problem is that this world has changed very slowly during thousands of years. This world has changed only very slowly and gradually. And now during the last few centuries, the world has changed at a much higher pace. And we have problems in keeping up with that. But on the other hand, we have the tools. We have historical tools. We have literary tools. We have hermeneutical tools. We have all the tools we need in order to disentangle these ancient texts and understand why they look like they do, what they meant to people back then, and what we can learn from them, and what we have to say no thank you to, because the preconceptions, the assumptions are no longer valid or no longer relevant. I think that's the only responsible way we can use religious texts today. Otherwise, you know, in the end, religion will end up in a museum as some kind of obsolete, silly phenomenon of past ages, if we do not respect the basic fact that religion is is a way of dealing with human life and existence existentially, based on our whole human history and what we have inherited from the past, but we need to interpret.
Yeah, oh, I absolutely agree. Context is so important. And to kind of sum up, I think I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't read the book yet, because the book is incredible and you should all go out and get it. And I have not mentioned the name of the book yet. Shame on me. And so it's called Dirt, Shame, Status, Perspectives on Same-Sex Sexuality in the Bible and the Ancient World. Go ahead and get it. But before I let you go, the last couple paragraphs in particular, just sum up the book so perfectly. And you have some great lines in the end. and so I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but I do think this line is a beautiful line, to share, where you say the death of hierarchy is the opportunity of love. Cause that's really what it comes down to. My biggest takeaway from your book is really looking at the fact that most of these references, regardless if that's what the original authors meant or not, really has way more to do with the power structure and the societal hierarchy and where you fell sort of on that ladder, and more so than it does in any way, shape, or form have to do with our modern conception of a consensual same-sex relationship.
Yeah. Some people tell me they are not so negative to hierarchies as I am. And of course, there are a lot of situations in which we need certain types of hierarchies, right? Everyone cannot decide everything at the same time, but we need structures and systems. So, of course, I acknowledge that. But this kind of hierarchy that governs, kind of restricts, restrains human relationships in various ways, and place us on a scale, on a ladder, and creates so much inequality. It's worth nothing. My computer files need a hierarchy. Otherwise, I won't find the files, right? But in many other cases, I think we should become hierarchy busters. There were people loving each other in antiquity, whether they were of the same sex or of opposite sexes. But hierarchies restrained the ways in which people could relate to each other and express themselves. And I'm afraid that hierarchies still restrain us in many ways today. We have far much more of hierarchy in our modern societies than we benefit from. I'm happy of that last sentence as well, actually. The death of hierarchy is opportunity of love. Love hardly survives hierarchy.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
That's such a great line and such an amazing way to tie your book together. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your research. I think this is it's been a very important topic. I think even more so now in light of what we're facing over here in the United States in terms of sort of the changes to laws or the potential changes to laws and the ways in which we protect and treat our folks that are our neighbors and brothers and sisters within the LGBTQ+ community. So be interesting to see how things go. But I think this is a very, very important topic to discuss. And I just appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure.
His face must look like yours. God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God that looks like us. Does God know my name? Is the ache in my soul just confined to my brain? Even so, it's not real. So take a breath, breathe it in. The mystery that is this. A universe we don't know. But I think the truth is, if God has a face, her face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. Face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill agent, even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face.
An O'Reilly Auto Parts gift card is the perfect gift for that hard-to-buy-for person. Give the gift of convenience from O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.